You are listening to the Unusually Well-Informed Podcast.
Welcome to the Unusually Well-Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Hampton. My unusually well-informed guests today are John Thacker and Jake Harrell. Together, John and Jake are hosts of a quality podcast where they discuss all things related to operational excellence, continuous improvement, lean, Six Sigma, leadership, and more. John is the author of How to Win Right Now as an Operations Supervisor. Jake is the author of Chasing Excellence. Today, John, Jake, and I are discussing the definition and pursuit of quality and explore the contrast between the lean approach of Toyota and the agile approach of Tesla. John and Jake, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tim. Hi, everybody.
Good to be here.
My pleasure. So I love the name A Quality Podcast. It has a quality ring to it. How did you two develop an interest in quality, and how did you decide to start a podcast?
I think John should take this one.
All right.
Okay, so in terms of our interest in quality, both of us kind of came up through the ranks and, you know, started out doing actual work, and throughout our careers developed a love for lean in particular because of its focus on people. And, you know, having been the people, we really appreciate that. I think both of us have different talents that complement each other. Jake is very engaging, gets along well with people, and he can take a crappy idea and get the team to act on it and get better. I'm a little bit on the other side. I don't engage as quickly with people. I'm not as much of a people person, but I am on the engineering spectrum, as we say. So I can take a really great idea and get subpar results with it. So the two of us together are a pretty awesome team. And I think, you know, Jake, you can speak for yourself, but at the end of the day, we actually like people and we want to see them win and succeed. And that's really the root of our love for lean, quality, continuous improvement, all of that.
That's what wakes me up in the morning.
And Jake, who came up with the name A Quality Podcast? How did that come about?
Well, I think it was John's, I don't want to say lack of imagination because the guy will hide it on camera, but got more imagination than either of us. But just a pragmatic, like, search engine optimization thought process. And guess what? The only thing that's searchable is quality. So you're only going to find us.
That's really good. Yeah, so I love it.
We had been having a conversation on the porch with some alcohol and cigars, and we were lamenting that there's not a quality podcast out there about fill in the blank. And so the name A Quality Podcast is a bit of a joke.
Yeah, it's experience. Right there in the tongue. I love it. So let me turn to Jake for a second. You wrote the book Chasing Excellence. Who is the target audience for that book?
Well, whoever's dumb enough to read it to start, but the inspiration came from while we, John and I, were working together on a project that everyone kept referring to gold standard. And reflecting back on my career, just about everywhere I've ever worked had some flavor of that, some vague aphorism on we want to be excellent, we want to be the gold segment, we want to be gilded in stone, or whatever popular phrase you like to use. So I wanted to like defenestrate that and then really dive into what do they mean? What do people mean when they say that? So the target audience is for people who really want to know how to solve barriers. You know, imagine the top of the hill as actual excellence, where you are now is not there. And everything between you is a barrier to that. And it's a pragmatic standard of approach to getting that outcome.
And when I read it, it struck me that it's not just for manufacturing, it's not just for warehouses. It's a pretty wide variety of possible uses, this book, right?
That is right. It is not industry specific in the slightest.
You inside the book, you wrote that PDCA is designed to be a recursive loop. So what is PDCA and why is it not just one and done?
Ooh, so, well, if we're asking about the standards, plan, do, check, act, or as some inferior people like to say, plan, do, study, adjust. it is literally just evaluate your current situation, taking action, check what that action did, adjust yourself accordingly. Now, the first time you do that, you might get successful results. You might not. Like the first time you cooked a meal, it might be good, it might be terrible, it might be edible, but intentionally iterating on, all right, we're going to plan to review this. We're going to adjust this, that, the other, and iterate in an infinite loop. You get better and better and better. And that's the whole model behind like the scientific method, hypothesis testing, and PDCA.
And this kind of work, this effort to make the task at hand run smoother, you use the expression that you should be doing this at the Gemba. So what do you mean by Gemba? And can the Gemba be, can it be Zoom call? Like how many different kinds of Gembas are there in the world?
Well, there's an infinite amount of Gemba. I will challenge that. I never directly use that term because I stay away from the Japanese terminologies. Okay. But anywhere, anybody is doing any actual thing. And that's more and more virtual as we move forward. I mean, the number one space I see in operations, like logistics, manufacturing, that they sort of set aside and don't focus on improvement projects is administrative. It's clerical. It's the time you're spending in task switching within salary groups. So assessing all of that, the Gemba becomes a virtual workspace that we all, so it can take many shapes or forms, but it's wherever work is actually being done.
Okay, thank you. And let me turn now to John. You wrote the book, How to Win Right Now as an Operations Supervisor. And in it, you talked about a business operating system. You made a couple of references to that. That's a really intriguing notion. Can you describe what a business operating system is?
Yeah, great. So business operating system is the collection of systems and processes that actually run the business. So for those that sort of dive a little bit deeper into operations management, industrial engineering best practices, and eventually Deming, we'll understand the concept of systems and systems of systems. The outcomes that we get in our businesses are the result of systems. We have processes that we follow, or at least practices that we follow, but we have systems for administrating everything. And they generate forces, dynamics within the business that ultimately result in the outcomes. So companies that want to get specific results and consistent specific results have to design their business operating system to get there. The book is really geared towards the frontline supervisor who has no say or power in the business operating system at all. And the operating system a particular site uses is not the business operating system. The business operating system is much larger. Mm-hmm. And so I've seen instances where the local site has sort of a lean management system in place, but corporate has cost accounting. And when that happens, they essentially undercut everything that's trying to be done at the local operation. That's the business operating system. And that's why the company's not overall getting the outcomes that should accrue through lean operations management.
I want to pick up on lean a lot more in a moment, but let me first turn to another concept in your book, and that is standard work. And, you know, as Jake was saying earlier, you know, this idea of when you cook something, you have a recipe, and if you follow the recipe, you can count on some sort of outcome. But what do you say to somebody like me who thinks that where they work, everything is as unique as a snowflake and I can't possibly do standard work?
That's a great question because that comes up a lot, right? So I think that sometimes the question or the attitude stems from a misunderstanding of what we mean by standard work. For starters, standard work is not a document. Standard work is a theory, and it's the theory that everybody does a task the same way. Now, when you're working in a highly custom environment, the way that you execute each individual task is going to be different. But if you did this individual task, or I did it, would we be following the same basic set of steps? If that's true, then you do have standard work. Documenting it can be a real headache in highly custom environments, particularly outside of product development and creation. Once you move into the services space, how do you deal with that angry customer at the hotel concierge desk? And the answer is, you probably have a guidebook of steps, but the way that you execute the step is going to be highly relative to that individual that you're dealing with. So standard work is less about move your arm 3 inches up and 4 inches to the left, grasp the tool handle, and is more about following the right steps in the right order. And I think that that concept, which is designed to produce predictable outcomes, is highly applicable.
Yeah, I like that. That does open the possibility of attempting to really review the processes, even if they're not the same every time. You can at least look at some of the points within. Yeah, that is helpful. In both your book and Jake's, there's a reference to the idea of visual management. What does that mean, and what are the advantages to that?
Good. So visual management is the ability to assess the health of the process as well as the outcomes of the process just by looking. So because of the proliferation of tools in the current workspace, some have maybe accidentally conflated a metrics chart, like a run chart, with visual management. Mm-hmm. In actuality, the best visual management, you wouldn't need a chart at all. You could watch the work being done and know the health of the process and the outcomes. But sometimes you need a scoreboard. Even a simple game like baseball needs a scoreboard. Does it really need one? I mean, we played slow pitch softball without one. We never had an argument about who won or lost, right? But it's very helpful for anybody that's not in the game. So if you dropped your kids off at soccer practice and you join your spouse at the softball game halfway through, you don't know the score because we can't afford a scoreboard. We just hit a ball around, right? Scoreboard changes that. Now people that are outside the process and sort of just stopping by can see at least the outcome of the process with a scoreboard. Excellent visual management also includes the ability to assess the health of the process itself.
Let me try a couple of examples to see if I understand the concept then. So I recently put together a chair with my son, an office chair, and it came, of course, with two arms, you know, armrests, and one was in a blue package and the other was in a clear package. It occurred to me suddenly that, oh, well, that's probably so you know that you have one of each kind in the box. It's as a goof-proof method. Is that an example of the kind of thing you're describing? Is that a simple example?
Yeah, I think that's a great example. So while that probably falls more under the category of poka-yoke for the factory operator, it's definitely visual management. So if I'm the person putting this flat pack together, I just need a blue and a red. Wait a minute, is this a left arm or a right? Or I get a whole box of right arms in a container that says left arms. Next thing you know, 1,000 chairs go out with two left arms.
Yeah.
Or right arm. By using the color packaging, that can be dramatically mitigated.
So let me try a different example that might be more on target with how that works. SpaceX, which is related through Elon to Tesla, which we're going to talk about later. The CEO of SpaceX was walking around the factory during an interview, Gwynn Shotwell, and she walked past a screen that drew a lot of people's eyes. And it was the bottom of a rocket in a pictorial fashion. And there were green and red rocket engine bell housings depicted on that. And you could tell how many were left to go. And it was a motivation for everybody in the plant. Is that closer to what you're describing?
I think so, particularly if that graphic had a way of indicating if the process of producing these bell housings was on track. Okay. Right? A good example of visual management for process health without a chart is WIP. So if you have operations in sequence, there's a certain amount of buffer calculated between this operation and this operation designed to absorb manufacturing variance between stations, right? If that WIP is in a sort of supermarket setup with a max and min quantity, then as the manager walks by, he can see, okay, the WIP is in the green zone. We have enough to absorb more than, say, three standard deviations from the mean, but we don't have enough to absorb six standard deviations from the mean. That would just be waste of inventory, right? So that type of supermarket visual management is a great way to assess process health just by walking by.
I forget it was, if it was in your book, but there was a mention somewhere that lean, the at least an apocryphal story that lean or Toyota production system was in part inspired by the grocery store, this idea that you had your inventory visible.
Yeah, that's correct. I honestly, I don't know if it's apocryphal or not. There's so much history out there. It's hard to separate sometimes what really happened from what sounds really cool. But that's the story is, you know, at the time we're talking about the early 50s, one of these executives took a trip to America. And of course, they didn't have supermarkets in Japan. And their economy was, you know, recovering from a very rough World War II. And after getting over fascination with the availability of goods, the first thing that his mind went to was, wait a minute, how do they do this? I've got a shelf full of stuff and I can just pick whatever I want. How on earth do they replenish that in an efficient way? How come they're not just running out of food? And the supermarket theory was sort of born out of that.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I like the way inspiration comes out of anywhere. So Jake and John, you've both been so well behaved, you know, in honor of this being my podcast. The remainder of the show, I'm going to ask both of you questions and you can overlap like you do on your own show. We'll try to understand as we go. But, you know, I love the spirited discussions that we have. So let's move on to talking about lean a little bit. The word lean appears a combined 34 times in your two books, the two books I've referenced today. What is lean and why is it important?
I will jump in with that. Lean is a philosophical approach that humans fundamentally have value, and it is our duty to add and cultivate that wherever possible.
I don't know what Jake's talking about. So lean is a theory of reducing the demand to cash time by eliminating waste in the value creation process. And it does that through two fundamental pillars, and that would be continuous improvement or Kaizen and respect for people. Jake hit on the respect for people pillar, and it's the critical and I think most frequently misunderstood or left out pillar, because at the end of the day, change and improvement is done by people, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the other is Kaizen, which is, I think, also sometimes misunderstood because it is fundamentally a mindset. And that mindset is we can always do better. Instead of being uncomfortable with the idea that I have to evolve and that I, as a frontline worker, am a critical part of evolving this business to stay competitive, instead, I'm uncomfortable with the opposite. If I go a week doing something the same way, now I'm uncomfortable. Well, wait a minute. Am I stagnant? What's going on here? I know there's a better way to do this. I know there's a better way to do this because today I went to the restroom at lunch and I had sweat under my armpits and grease under my fingernails. And in a perfect world, I wouldn't have those two things, right? That tells me that I'm working. If I'm working, there's an opportunity for improvement. So that would be my sort of nutshell lean. Why it's so important. If you look at the history of industry, right, and we can just go back a couple hundred years, we don't have to go farther than that. Post-industrial revolution, how many companies that were around 100 years ago are doing things the same way that they were 100 years ago? Now, in those 100 years, how many companies aren't around anymore? Studebaker, you know, you can think of all kinds, Kodak. I mean, I don't think they're a company anymore. They used to be at the top of the world.
Right.
Radio Shack.
Radio Shack. The list goes on and on, right? And these were all companies that were at the top of their game at some point. What happened was they failed to continuously improve. They didn't innovate. They didn't adapt. They became ossified, and they could no longer keep up with changes in the world. And that's why lean is so important. It allows a business to continue feeding families and continue employing people. Because at the end of the day, it's not about the company. It's not about the brand. It's not about the money. It's about keeping people alive and well and healthy, and really even generational change as normal, regular people are given the opportunity to be excellent and earn a good living.
Mm-hmm. So there's a few themes in there I really want to pick up on. But first, I want to ask your thoughts, both of you, on is the Toyota production system and lean one and the same, or is one a derivation of the other? Should they be used synonymously?
Well, I think that to dive in, as John will give you a very good apples to oranges comparison, I would just like to start by saying people refer to lean in 100 different ways. Like, you ask two people, their definition's different. I don't mean to make a religion about it, but we've come up with a sort of jargon where we say lean and we really mean a lot of different things. So I'm sure there's plenty of folks where on a Venn diagram, TPM and lean are approaching the same, and there's several people where they're completely divergent. And like within my view, they're both highly correlated but separate systems of trying to get the same or similar outcome.
Yeah, I think that's a great description. I think that it's critical for successful business managers and consultants to come to terms with reality the way that it is as rapidly as possible. And the truth is, if you go to five different companies that call themselves lean companies and you look at what they're doing, you'll find out that they're very different. At the core philosophical level, they're not all the same. So Toyota Production System launched lean and is still kind of the gold standard for business operating system, at least in their particular space.
You had to say it. Gold standard.
Yeah. I heard it right away, Jake.
It's the chasing excellence of
yes,
automotive production. But really, lean is a very loose or inclusive metaphor. We would say in linguistics, right? The extension of the word is very broad, mm-hmm, to encompass some ideas, mm-hmm, some tools, a lot of different ways of doing things. You know, you have companies that are Lean Six Sigma. Well, Toyota doesn't use Six Sigma. Are they not lean then? I don't know. And I'm not sure how fruitful the conversation is. What's important is to understand what's actually happening and how can I make it better?
Yeah, to add to that, there is, you can ascribe to any system and get good, great, or terrible results. Literally any system. Your outcomes are generally defined by how well a broader group of your business group ascribe to said system. And the system is rather interchangeable. There's some that are better than others, some that are worthless, some that are great. And I mean, as evidenced in any political system, you can have absolutely terrible political regimes that get good results on a given topic and great ones that don't get such good results. So it's about ascribing to a system even more than it is what system you're ascribing to.
Well, this is what I love about your podcast, gentlemen, because you're very pragmatic. And you also have a variety of guests with different viewpoints on. So I really do enjoy that. So let's, for the listeners, and honestly to educate me, what distinguishes lean from, what is the previous way of doing things before lean came along, and what made lean better?
Ooh, great historical question. Jake, do you mind if I grab this one?
Go for it.
Okay, so...
And then I'm going to attack whatever he says, just so
sure,
you know.
Sure, perfect.
Perfect. Lean is an evolution. It wasn't like a light switch that flipped. And it really comes out of scientific management. So there's a few different names, you know, that we can go back to. Of course, Frederick Winslow Taylor is pretty famous for his scientific management. I believe that was 1911. He did a lot of work sort of applying physics to operations. There was another fellow whose name slips my mind, but he had a time studies work also published in 1911. And he added in this collection of specific activities to reduce setup time in factories. So that, you know, that was different. Now, Taylor had mentioned that setup time was a waste, but he didn't really give any ideas of how to address it. And then Henry Ford had quite a bit of innovation, obviously with the assembly line. And I think maybe they fell prey to a little bit of insularity in their company, perhaps a little bit of hubris. But they published Ford Methods and Shops, I think is the name of the, it's sort of a booklet. I have it somewhere. And they talk about some methods they use to reduce like machine changeover times, et cetera. And so even with Toyota and the Toyota production system, you know, originally it was the Toyota Automatic Loom Company. You know, they didn't make cars, they made looms. Mr. Toyota was really interested in how he could reduce the burden on his employees, because this was, you know, backbreaking work. You can look at the old photos of, you know, grubby 8-year-olds running across these machines back before we had laws about that sort of thing. You know, it was really tough work. So as the, I guess, progression or evolution of operations management and production moved through the 20th century, we also had some forced upheaval through two world wars. And particularly in World War II, it was sort of a I don't know, black swan event, if you will, that forced people to rethink how they were doing things. And the War Manpower Commission's training within industry program that came out of that was the bedrock for lean, and really all of the operational excellence that has come out of that. And so back when politicians knew how to work with each other, they came up with this commission, and training within industry was basically the outcome of a lot of smart people at major universities collaborating on the latest in psychology, adult learning, all of that sort of thing. And so Toyota built on that, and what facilitated their, I guess, rapid improvement, their ability to move faster than the rest of industry, was their founding principles, the Kaizen and the respect for people. But the spark plug there was the fact that they just didn't have resources. They had to be lean, right? In this post-World War II, I'm making cars in this country. And so they sort of pulled the rest of industry along with them as they rapidly achieved things that people didn't think they were able to achieve. Until today, you know, there's it's very difficult to find an automobile manufacturer that's not doing a lot of the same things, right?
Right.
So I don't see lean as, you know, like flipping the switch, you know, a Schumpeterian event so much as natural evolution through time, as we continue to learn and build on the body of knowledge.
Speaking of Toyota production system, and you've brought this up earlier, John, is the idea of continuous improvement. And I think, Jake, you referenced that as well. It's an important principle. In this context, where is continuous improvement being applied? Is it being applied just to the production process or throughout the company? How big is that PDCA loop?
I love that, because it is contextually applied, and some people like to do improvement for the sake of improvement with no direction, and I've only ever seen that have subpar results. So the first thing you should do within a facility is get stabilized processes that have stabilized outcomes. Measure them in some visual way, and then when something signals you there is a problem, then let's have this discussion and grow. And your time outside of there, you need to spend it out within the operation, seeing exactly how items flow and evaluating at all levels, what can we, you know, make or change. But definitely the direction needs to be measured and contextual to the environment.
Okay. Yeah, so this kind of ties in with the question about the business operating system, right? So let's say that you have a production plant. We'll just call it a factory. That's easy, right? And we're producing widgets, and we're now able to produce the same amount of widgets in 80% of the time. Big whoop. Like, really, who cares? If you're only selling this many widgets, mm-hmm. It kind of doesn't matter. In fact, it actually adds some issues for you as a leader. So we're doing it in 80% of the time. Does that mean I only pay people 80%? Right? If they're not getting 40 hours a week, retention is going to be pretty tough. But I also hate wasting 20% of labor costs. Oh, I know, we can get rid of people. You're done. The mm-hmm. end. Right? So to capture that, you have to have the whole business oriented around the same philosophies and principles. Right? So for example, with Toyota, they're obsessed with the consumer. Right? And supplying what the consumer needs and listening to the consumer. And then how quickly can I get you what you want? Right. If I could build your custom hot pink RAV4, you know, one of one as efficiently as we're producing cars, I would do that. I would prefer to do that. But that's going to cost $100,000 per car. And price is an important consideration, right? Interestingly, Toyota was probably the leader in being able to add customization to cars in an efficient way. So back in the 60s and 70s, GM went on this thing where, like, you know, they had 19 packages and you could mix and match and pick and choose. And it makes restoring classic cars a real nightmare, keeping up with all of the equipment codes and all of that. Well, initially, of course, Toyota had a lot less selection. You know, it's like Ford, you can have any color you want as long as it's black, which is an apocryphal story, by the way. And then they rapidly added in the capability of producing much more highly customized vehicles. Today, if you were to, you know, build your favorite car, what you'll find is that, you know, Toyota is right up there with the best companies at providing customizable vehicles. We're just going to set the German cars over here, though, because their model is to make money off of adding air conditioning and stuff to the car. So it's a little different. You can customize anything you want and double the price of your already expensive car.
Yes, absolutely. Speaking of GM, back in the day, they say that if you multiplied all the engine options, transmission options, color options, pinstripe options, wheel options, it'd be more combinations than there are atoms in the universe. I don't know if that's true, but that's what they said back in the day. So I do remember that. And that actually has an impact on the Tesla story that we're coming to. And I'm just sort of nibbling my way up to it. But one of the things about Teslas is they say that every third car that comes off the assembly line is different than the one before. And that is a challenge for that. 50 years from now, when you're restoring a Model 3, you might have a hard time. So I don't know if I shared this article with you by John McElroy, who is an automotive journalist who's been around. He's very Detroit. If you cut him open, he bleeds transmission fluids. I remember his show back from when it was on cable. Like, I've been a fan of this guy. And he began, I think it was Autoline Detroit. I don't think it was called Auto. He wasn't the global guy. He was the Detroit guy in the beginning. And so for him to come out recently and say that maybe we should unlearn what we learned from Toyota and learn from Tesla, if he says that, then it must be something that a lot of people in the automotive industry are thinking. And so what he wrote, first of all, the title, as I said, was Unlearning What Toyota Taught Us. And then the subtitle is Today the Automotive World is Changing. EV startups, notably Tesla, have ripped Toyota's game plan to shreds. They're moving at lightning speed, taking daring steps with new technology and breaking the old business models. So my read on this is the Toyota production system is built for quality and not for speed. Is that a fair description?
I think yes and no. I think the Toyota production system is built for consistency. And when you think about the technical definition of quality in industrial engineering, consistency is like most of it, right? Obviously, you could be consistently poor quality, right? But there's actually a market for that, right?
BMW.
McDonald's. Bazinga. McDonald's sells billions and billions served. Nobody upholds them as like the pinnacle of hamburger.
Sure.
Right? But it's consistent.
You can eat a bag of McNuggets while driving down the road without even looking at it because it's that consistent.
Correct. Right. Yeah. So I think it's built towards consistency, but they've always been concerned with reducing the cash to delivery time for their products. That's always been what they're geared towards. I think that Tesla began in a certain era when what was available to them was radically different. And so probably not a great metaphor, but one could be, you have a Ferrari from the 60s and you're continuously improving that Ferrari, you're going to have a really fast, really beautiful car. But if you start from scratch, you can build a brand new Honda Civic Type R that is faster around a racetrack than that Ferrari.
Right, right.
Yeah, I think to your point on consistency, at some point, if you want to be consistent at anything, you do have to limit your ability to adjust in some shape or form. You have to adjust with control to maintain some level of consistency. So you can't be infinitely agile and infinitely consistent. There's a like a Kano model of giving up one for the other. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, so this is there's to me, it feels like a bit of a contradiction because we're talking about continuous improvement in one area, which would be easier to do if nothing else changed. And of course, that's not reality, right? And you guys are very pragmatic. And I know that, you know, sometimes you need to focus your lens on where to do the Kaizen, and sometimes you need to pull it back. And I think that what a couple of observations, like John, you and I are going to make car analogies that won't make sense to anybody else. But if I come out with version 2 or version 3 or version 4 of a Camry, it's going to be like 10% better than the one before. I can take 4 years to do that and not fall behind the market. But in an era where you're coming out with new EVs that you're dramatically changing the performance of, you can't wait 4 years to come out with the next version. So continuous improvement can't just apply to the production process. It has to apply to what you're producing. Do you think that this is a temporary phenomenon and eventually asymptotically EVs will approach perfection and we can slow down and return to the TPS model? Or is what I'm viewing as an agile approach to car production the way going forward?
Well, it's a good question. And I'm going to dive into a little bit of philosophy here, right? So the first thing is it's probably important to note that whoever comes out on top is upheld as the standard, right? That's sure. Just history, right? Winners write the history books, all of that, right? Mm-hmm. Toyota is the largest auto manufacturer in the world and the most profitable by a large, large margin. And so, of course, they're upheld as, hey, they're doing something right. Mm-hmm. If 20 years from now, Tesla is on top of the automotive world, then everyone is going to tout the Tesla operating system as being awesome, right? So we have to understand that there's a sort of human phenomenon of looking at winners and how can we copy them, which, you know, that doesn't mean that's what's good for you, right? That goes back to, you know, the pragmatic, what are the facts right now? What is the world really like for me, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the first sort of bit of context when we discuss this. The second has to do with consumerism. The reason Tesla's as successful as they are is because the consumers allow it. You know, I've seen videos of Tesla's falling apart, right? Now, that's probably not fair. They sold 500,000 vehicles this year, I think. You know, if two or three have a roof fly off, right? That's not a high percentage. Well, it is for every other auto manufacturer on the planet,
right?
But you know what? The people buying Teslas don't care. Mm-hmm. The performance is insane. They have a cool factor that no other car can match. And you're saving the planet at the same time.
Yeah.
Saving the planet, right? We're buying them. That's mm-hmm. the thing. Tesla can't keep up with mm-hmm. the demand. So as long as the consumers are buying that, then why wouldn't you produce it? So Tesla has a completely different mindset, which is that Silicon Valley, move fast and break things, produce a mediocre product, come back and fix it. The actual product design, development, deployment is really what sets Tesla apart from the traditional automobile manufacturing space. It's less so much their production methods or production management, and it's their philosophy around product generation and how they relate to the customer.
Yeah, they're a tech startup. They're not an automobile company, as far as I'm concerned. And it's important to note that comparing the two, there are little apples and oranges, as you talked about, constantly redesigning rather than make your current process better. Well, even within like the Toyota model, you know, Kaizen and being right in the middle of a continuous process and trying to adjust something is still a whole different prospect from a complete process redesign, which is what's happening, you know, essentially annually with Tesla's model. Mm-hmm. So you still need some variety of both. You definitely need both. We would have never been to space if we kept just, you know, making the wheel a little better, you know.
Yeah, it's the whole Kaizen versus Kaikaku thing, right? So, you know, one of the things Tesla does differently is they just, you know, break the mold and start over, right? And so it's not a super efficient way to do things, but we do live in a consumer culture where people are comfortable with throwing things away. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have cell phones you can work on anymore. And if we're being honest, we don't have cars you can work on anymore.
Right.
Right. And so most people own their vehicle for a certain amount of time and then get rid of it one way or the other. And sort of where you are in the life cycle of the car depends on your personal choices and capabilities. Right. So I like to drive cars that are 10 years old or so. Insurance isn't great because they're a little less safe than the cars, you know, that are newer, but they cost so little.
Yeah.
You know, that it balances out. Other people, I'm going to lease a car for 2 years. I'm trading in for a new model, right? But everyone has a buy point and a sell point. Mm-hmm. So we're not throwing it in the landfill, but we also can't distinguish, like as consumers, the difference between using something and getting rid of it and using something and putting it in the trash, right? It really is a consumerist consumption mindset. And that allows Tesla to take a completely different approach. If you have the money and you're willing to spend it on something that's new and exciting and different, mm-hmm. then I'm gonna provide that for you. And we do it already.
Let me push back a little bit on what I'm inferring from what you're saying. It seems to me that you're taking the viewpoint that Tesla can get away with making a low quality product because it's a throwaway society, like kind of the BMW argument. It'll blow up shortly after the warranty. Have fun while you can. But that's not true. If you look at resale values on Teslas, there you can often sell it for more than you bought it. That's an indication of some version of quality. And their warranty repair costs are lower than industry.
Yeah, two good points, right? So touching on the warranty part, right? Electric vehicles are much simpler.
Absolutely. And
less maintenance, all of that, which is very attractive, particularly, you know, if I can't work on my car anyway, then I might as well get one that doesn't need to be worked on, right? But also, when we talk about quality, this is really interesting because a lot of what passes for quality is a sales tactic, particularly in the automotive industry. So we've all seen these J.D. Power, you know,
J.D. Power and Associates ranks most durable car of the year. And they roll a Toyota Tacoma off a mountain.
Yeah. So the initial quality rankings is number of complaints per unit sold. Right. That's how they measure that. Okay. If your complaint is that my transmission blew up, that's very different from I couldn't navigate my touchscreen very easily.
Right.
Right. But they don't make that distinction. Mm-hmm. So here's some things about Teslas that you'll see. The body panels are not as well positioned as the competition. Yeah, but a Mazda has body panels that are within half a millimeter. And the gap between the two is 2 millimeters. So the Tesla has a gap of 4 millimeters. Does anybody except people doing YouTube videos notice that or care?
Right.
When it's going by you at 80 miles an hour, you sure can't see it. Right? So
that's why I didn't buy one. I was going to buy it this year, but the extra 2 millimeters just...
The extra two it's millimeters in body panel, right? And so I think it's important to distinguish because the fundamental point of the car is transportation. Teslas do that part pretty reliably, and they do it in a modern cockpit that is more in keeping with, you know, how people grew up. They now have the fungible assets to buy a new car.
Sorry, go ahead, Jake.
The people that are buying Teslas today had an iPad in front of their face their entire childhood. So yes, we want it on the dashboard. Yes, we do.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is that there aren't too many reliable cars that'll do 0 to 60 in 3, right? If you look at the panel gaps on a Maserati, I doubt they're as good as a Tesla.
No, that's an excellent point, which is, for the performance, good luck getting anything that's even close to the reliability of a Tesla. And they do have first mover advantage. You know, maybe someone will come along and figure out how to make an electric vehicle with the same performance and maybe better quality.
Sure.
But are they ever going to catch Tesla?
Well, and this is, and I think this is, that question is central to this conversation, because the argument I'm sort of tabling is that if Toyota is improving in a step change fashion, you know, they wait 4 years and come out with all the improvements versus Tesla almost daily coming out with improvements to their vehicle, which the vehicles are not necessarily, a lot of them are noticeable by the consumer, but a lot of them actually make the vehicles cheaper to produce, which is another huge advantage, right? Because they made this promise of 1 million Model 3s at 35 grand. They didn't have the ability to do that. And you can't get too far making 1 million cars at a loss. So they really had to, as they went, figure out how to ways to work out cost. But I forget where I was going with that. I apologize. I guess I want to really put the central tension between what I'm viewing as agile and lean. And that is this idea that you need to finalize your design before you start producing the car versus the agile process, which is they're one and the same. You work on them at the same time. John, you referred to Toyota being able to customize the car. Like I can say, I don't know what I'd do to customize a Sierra or a RAV4. Maybe I want leather instead of like that. I don't know how many options there are in a RAV4, but I customize it. It rolls down the line with some sort of build sheet that explains what that vehicle is going to have in it. They're able to customize a little bit. Could they not expand on that to say, we're going to also have experimental versions running down the production line and track them to see how they're doing? So adopt some of that. Is it all or nothing? I guess what I'm saying is, do we have to throw out lean to be agile?
No, I don't think so. I think that there's a lot of overlap with lean and agile, and as well as some other management tools such as Six Sigma, and a lot of them can work together. It really comes down, I hate to say it, but it comes down to semantics, right? Mm. If by lean you mean I am trying to reduce the demand to cash time by eliminating waste, you can basically achieve that through Agile, right? And that's where the earlier discussion about, well, what's the difference between TPS and Lean is valuable, right? TPS is, or it's a management system, it's a business operating system. It might have to change, it might have to evolve, right? And it has been evolving, right? Whereas if Lean is really that theory, that broad of a theory, how you execute that, how you get there, can change and can evolve. Mm-hmm. One thing that I would note is, if you're talking about reducing demand to cash time, Tesla has made the biggest evolution in history to reduce that by cutting out the dealership. Mm-hmm. Just by that really, frankly, obvious step. By the way, I would love for people to comment under the video if they had loved their dealership. Right? I want to know how many people out there just enjoy the dealership experience.
Oh, that's definitely going to increase engagement on the show. Thank you very much. I'll get lots of people telling me that.
So, you know, we're talking about reducing demand to cash time. Well, Tesla already just leapfrogged everybody by saying, you know what, we're going to cut out the least efficient part of purchasing a new automobile. And they kind of gain these raving fans at the same time. It's like, hey, wait a minute. This is what I grew up with. This is modern. This company isn't stuck in the 19th century. I'm going online. I want this, this, and this. Boop. Someone drops it off at my front door. Win.
Yeah.
Like, I'm the center of attention here.
Yeah. The other comment I throw in the middle of there is, it's almost as if you're saying, why doesn't Toyota try to be more like Tesla? And if I'm Toyota, I'm not incentivized to do that. Why would I? Why would I have a multi-billion dollar successful company with assets that consistently produce reliable results? Would I care what Tesla does? I mean, Tesla's not even playing the same game. I mean, eventually, they're going to cannibalize each other, but where they are now, it's not even the same market. Like, you buy a Tesla, you know, there's a certain status there. It's a certain type flavor of person that buys that Tesla that is not your Toyota consumer.
It's true.
People are cross shopping, right?
Yeah. Well, do I want a Corolla or do I want a Tesla?
Well, no. Well, or do I want a Prius or do I want a Tesla is a possible cross shop. But I think the other cross shop is, there are two curves that are going against Tesla. One is the adoption of EVs. It looks small in the beginning, but it's an S curve and it's going to 100% eventually. You know, maybe not worldwide. There will be some markets where it's not practical, but. And then the other thing is the cost of an EV versus a, you know, if I can get a Tesla that is in every way comparable in terms of safety and size and performance to a Camry, but I plug it in and I can run it for $10 of electricity a week, that's a win that I can't sell a Camry against. And so the longer Toyota doesn't come forward with a compelling EV, the more in jeopardy they are, I think. I mean, that's sort of my thesis on this. And I will say, I'm not comparing Toyota to Tesla because of EVs. I'm comparing because of this apparent, that distinction between the step change and the continuous change that Tesla seems to be able to do. Toyota has bigger problems than, can they change their cars quickly? It's because they're not making EVs. It's the big problem. Like, when do you switch over? Do you wait until your margins on ICE cars are negative and then switch? Now you don't have any money, but you have all your legacy costs. So they're in trouble for lots of reasons besides not being agile, I think.
Well, I would comment that I think even if all of the infrastructure was in place, like, let's zone in on just North America, mm-hmm. I'm not speaking for the rest of the world, but even if all of the infrastructure was in place that you could have an electric car anywhere, which isn't really the case today, and the cost were comparable, let's say Tesla was even moderately cheaper than the Toyota Corolla, I still don't think a large percentage of that consumer base is going to hop over. If they would, we wouldn't be in this situation where big oil and gas, the second we had, you know, solar and electric power source went, why aren't we all on board? It's cheaper, more effective, better for the environment. No, instead, like, we just dug in deeper and said, all right, well, we're going to start turning drills sideways and suck oil out the rest of this place. We just dug our claws in deeper. We didn't give up and go, well, let's all be electric. I don't think it's going to take a lot more than that for society to make that leap.
Well, yeah, I don't think it needs to be a leap, though. I think it can be a mincing step up the S-curve. And the only question is how fast it is in my mind. But I take your point. I mean, I drive a V6 SUV because, you know, I'm pragmatic, too. And I wanted a comfortable, safe vehicle that, you know, that I could afford. So I do take your point, but I can't see myself buying another gas car. But I've said that before too. So we'll see what pragmatism leads to. John, did you want to add something to that?
Yeah, I think the observation about methodology and Toyota sort of lagging behind is interesting for two reasons. The first is that we have not seen Toyota innovate in over a decade. In fact, the two sports cars that Toyota currently sells are produced by different companies.
Yeah.
So when it was time for them to bring back the Supra name, it's a BMW. Now, for a guy like me, I will not buy that vehicle.
Sure.
I don't trust BMWs, particularly that inline six motor with the plastic water impeller, et cetera, et cetera. And then their low-end budget sports car is a Subaru. Right. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, is annoying because Subaru also is known for having glass engines, right? Unless it's an STI. So they haven't been able to sort of produce something new and innovate in quite some time. I'm not sure why, if something has changed or if it is so much more cost effective that they think it's okay to sell a Toyota with parts that literally have the BMW Rondel stamped into them under the hood. Mm-hmm. Something's going on there, but it is interesting to note, I think it was last week or the week before, I think it was 2 weeks ago, was the global unveil of the first Toyota EV.
Right.
It's a crossover, like a Highlander size, I think. So, you know, something that pretty much everybody wants to buy. Great choice for a first EV. Mm-hmm. Again, this is a levered partnership, right? So just like the Supra and the GR86, right? They're leveraging really somebody else to produce this vehicle. So it may be that they've evolved in the space to the point where they're almost more like a broker. Where they can essentially use multiple manufacturers around the world to produce Toyota branded stuff. And that may be the future of the company. I don't know. I'm not a brand strategist.
No.
I'm not really into that sort of thing. But I think it's well taken. Like, they can't fall that far behind because they will never catch up. And there's already many articles out there outlining that to catch up with Tesla, you're going to have, you know, this breakthrough event. Like, I figured out how to generate electricity from cement or something, you know, or like, you know, some kind of plastic battery, because you don't have 100 engineers working specifically on this technology year over year over year,
right?
With feedback, telematics from the cars that are out on the road being used by real people. Yeah. I mean, that would be very challenging for any company to catch up with.
Yeah, I mean, we're departing from a question of, is it just agile versus lean? But I mean, there are many things about what's going on for Toyota that are difficult. One is nobody buys sports cars anymore. Like you pointed out, everybody wants an SUV. They want it to drive as fast as a sports car. But, you know, all the boomers and people our age are like, I don't want to fall into a car. I want
to step into it. Were you talking to John there?
Sorry, Jake. You know, I know you grew up with an iPad, but John and I, you know, like to get up into a car. Walter P. Chrysler. Do you remember that quote? That when Chevy came out with the low slung car for its day, I imagine you could see over it. He said, at Chrysler, we build cars to sit in, not piss over. Have you ever heard that quote?
I have not, but that sounds great.
So one of the things about Agile is that it promotes self-organizing teams. So when I mentally picture a Toyota production line, I can see people doing Kaizen at their station, but I don't necessarily see them looking up to see what's going on in the rest of the factory. self-organizing teams in Agile is not just so that, you know, everybody can follow their bliss. It's so that they can follow the biggest problem of the day. And when the problems are that you might need to redesign something to make it better as it goes, like the Octavalve in the Tesla, this system that integrates all the different heating and cooling needs within the vehicle in one sort of package. You couldn't do that if you were just working on the battery cooling system or the HVAC system. Is Lean necessarily not agile in that respect? Or do you see occasions when people are leaving their own teams to work elsewhere in the organization?
So I think that we're dealing with the evolution in adult learning. As psychology continues to study and do their science thing and learn about how people learn and work together and that sort of thing, Agile is based on a deeper understanding of how humans operate and optimize. And if we're being honest, most lean really is still built on old-fashioned management structures, like top-down. It's some pyramid shape, right? It might be a pyramid like this or a pyramid like that. And you have these boundaries and you stay in your box and you color very neatly between the lines, and somebody comes with an audit sheet and makes sure you're coloring between the lines, and then goes over here and then goes down into sort of this cell and does the same thing. And at some point, like, these things merge, right? But it's a different philosophy. It's also, inherently less agile, not agile, like registered trademark.
Small A, yeah.
Yeah, small A. It's less agile necessarily. And here's the key, right? And this is going to upset some lean people, but it is less effective at capturing people's creativity and their belonging as part of it.
Well, but that's an interesting choice of words, John, because you use the word effective. And I think that that's what's going on with Toyota right now, is they're extremely efficient, but they're assuming that effectiveness is already in hand. We're making Camrys and Corollas. Everybody likes Camrys and Corollas. They're getting a little bit better every year. They're not rethinking, well, what would be more effective? What would truly meet the needs of people? It's a different vehicle altogether. So that's a really interesting choice of words. John, Jake, did you want to come in there for a sec?
Before I attacked John for that, I had to have a deep moment of self-reflection and just think of, like, most of the brand and, like, who I'm, you know, selling while I'm online and out in the world is trying to, like, value your personal creativity and your humility and respect. And the way I go about that is not defined in any lean book I've ever read outside of mine, right? Like, it's just not. So none of the tools that have definitions that are out there posted and readily available address capturing people's belonging and creativity. So as much as I hate it and want to grip my teeth and fight the guy next time I see him, I have to agree that his statement is true.
I've done my job. I've created a feud between John and Jake. Well, I'm sure we'll hear about this on the next show.
After party.
Yeah. So, gentlemen, this has been terrific. And I want to thank you for coming on the show and sharing your thoughts. I have one final question. We're going to leave Toyota and Tesla out of it. So we're approaching the holidays, and a lot of people put up decorations year after year. Do you have any standard work suggestions so people can make that more efficient this year?
Yes, I do. So for starters, the most efficient thing you can do for your holiday decorations is to go purchase a large yard insert of the Grinch. And then all you have to do is take your string of lights, dump them on the ground next to the Grinch, and you're done. Decorations over. Hey, he stole them all. You know, I couldn't put them up. On a more serious note, if you are engaging in holiday decoration, please practice safety. These things do run on electricity. If I were to put a standard work in place, the most important part would be, if you don't understand what amperage draw is, put that other string of lights away.
Yeah. Oh, and well, ladder safety would be another issue.
My holiday decor is all internal combustion. So it is a very efficient and effective. It's a standard way. We've been doing it for years.
Yeah.
That's what we're sticking with.
I think the current technology is referred to as internal combustion, not spontaneous combustion. So good luck. Good luck this holiday. Gentlemen, this has been terrific. Thank you very much for joining me on the show.
Thank you, Jim.
My unusually well-informed guests were John Thacker and Jake Harrell. My name is Tim Hampton, and you can reach me at tim@unusuallywellinformed.com. Thanks for listening. I hope you will subscribe and join me for the next show with another unusually well-informed leader in business and technology.
Thank you for listening to the Unusually Well-Informed podcast.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on the Unusually Well-Informed podcast are their own and do not reflect that of their employer or any other affiliation.